Hello, Vishnu. How are you doing?
Hey Joe, thanks for having me. It's good to catch up after a while.
Yeah. I think we last time I saw you was in Bangalore.
Yeah, at the data engineering conference, the DuCon, I think it was. Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. What have you been up to since then?
The boring part of what I've been up to is heads down, just focused on making progress on building the company. I think our work takes us into some fairly stressed out environments right now, so trying to be mindful of what it takes to build a company under such circumstances, especially when the folks we work with on the other side of the table, large data teams, they're pretty stressed right now. So I think one hand, try not to be too pushy and while still helping. So and yeah, it's a super interesting challenge, building what we are and working with the types of folks we are. So it's always interesting. It's very intellectually stimulating. So it's yeah, so no complaints there.
And I think we were meaning to do a podcast for a while, actually, because I think when I realize what you're working on over at E6, I was like, okay, this is a bit different than other things I've seen. Can you briefly describe what you're building?
Sure. So zooming out, so if we just get to the why of what we're building, right? Like I think the belief that we have is that it's just fundamentally valuable to build a more efficient anything, right? A more efficient car engine, jet engine, like database engine. And we felt that, we could take a meaningful stab at that problem. Given everything that we were seeing around us, like just multiple factors that were each feeding into the need for more compute consumption along sort of the usual vectors, each of which sort of operate independently, right? So we felt that, hey, it'll be cool, both it'll be fun and it'll be valuable to potentially build a different type of an analytical compute engine. So that's what we sort of set out to do, and we're doing this under like a very different set of constraints, an acutely different set of constraints than a lot of other companies. So we're trying to stay under the radar, try and make sure we can get an engine that can sit within a customer's cloud account and run high performance analytics at substantially more efficient cost points, right? So than is possible today. So that's at a super high level what we do.
That's interesting. So, I mean, compute and query engines for analytics have been around for a long time, and I think I'd love to get your take on this in a bit. But it feels like, where do you feel the market is right now? Because I think that there's the big players who I'm not going to name, and then it seems like there's companies like E6 that are coming out, and I think have their own take on it. Like, where do you see the market is right now? Is it ripe for an inflection point, or is there still room for the big players to keep growing their offerings?
I think both, right? Like, so, I'm often asked the question, hey, is this a phase where you see a lot of consolidation or stacks getting sort of more composable and open? And I think at the entry level of the market, you'll always favor simplicity, right? Just get the job done with the least number of tools, no fuss, right? And I guess as you get to a size and level of sophistication where what you spend is in the millions of dollars or at least hundreds of thousands of dollars, and all this stuff is like super mission critical to you, you do care about details. You care about small things, right? Like you break up a large like vertical stack into its constituent blocks, try to squeeze out performance and whatever else you're trying to achieve through individual blocks. So I think both will simultaneously happen. So the large folks, whether on the warehouse side or on the lakehouse side, will grow their base of users, and as those users mature, right, there will be that like top end of the market where more niche players like us, let's say, or others would definitely find like takers. So that's my take.
That's interesting. And I would like to get your take on this too. you know, when we were hanging out in Bangalore, we were actually, I think it was you and Vinoth from Hoodie and yeah. and we were talking. But what's your impression on I guess the rise of open table formats and how that affects the engine for or the sorry the market for compute engines?
I mean, it's huge, right? Like, we couldn't be doing what we are, if it wasn't for the rise of open table format, right? Like Hoodie, Iceberg, and Delta. And I think both from the sheer, from the pure technological angle in terms of what they make possible, as well as the evangelism angle, right? Like, so let's face it, they're really good at like talking about why this is valuable, who needs it, and how to get on that stack in a fairly easy way. So I would say we owe a huge debt of gratitude to the open table formats.
Yeah.
And it's just lowered the bar, I think, and made sort of the big data stack feel less big and less intimidating. So which is, I think, a huge, huge win.
That's interesting. What are some of the trends that you're seeing?
Yeah, I think, a few, like, let me just break up my answer into a few sorts of buckets, right? So
yeah.
I think one definite thing that we're seeing is there's like a spectrum of applications and within the same company, and the extreme right end or the extreme heavy end of the spectrum bears little or no resemblance to the extreme sort of low end, right? Like a very one-off ad hoc query that you want to run to check on some metrics is very different from a system that runs like 10, 20 million analytical queries a day, right? Mm. Which is always on. It only scales like from a base level to a peak, but never down to zero, right? And those I think are like super different. And we see that end of the spectrum being sort of still owned by people with like super strong software engineering chops, who either come from the software engineering background or enter data engineering via software engineering,
right,
and bring that sort of a mindset, which I think is like a welcome thing, frankly, right? Like lots of cross-disciplinary learnings come into this space. So that's one piece of the puzzle, right? Like mission critical, heavy duty, millions of queries, like tight determinism type of applications that we see. Also, I think, we've always been, I count myself in that bucket, a little, I always push back on someone when they say real time or we need real time. I'm a recent convert, right? Like, including some of the common events that, where some of the teams from the large organizations presented. And they make quite a compelling case for why their business needs real time. And the open table formats, again, play in, they enable that in a massive way. So that solves like one piece of the puzzle. And the other obviously is, hey, can compute engines, keep up their end of the bargain, right? Like make sure that the querying piece is also performant, cost-effective, and so on. But apart from that, which is sort of, I guess, a very basic, a low-level answer to your question, I think there is a lot that's happening around, I think, what you in your book and your data engineering flow call the underpinnings, or I forget what.
Undercurrents, yeah.
Yeah, undercurrents, right? Like, I think those are getting more important blocks, like, discoverability, governance, data ops, observability, those types of things. We're hearing those more and more.
Interesting.
Yep.
Huh. Those are really boring things. Like, why do you hear more about those?
I think it's just, so my views could be like extremely non-representative just because of the,
of course,
the type of company that we end up talking to, right? So I think at that scale, this stuff just becomes like, your life is hell without it. So the boring stuff actually makes life a lot more enjoyable, allows you to focus on the core of your work, I guess.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I think there is this whole, it feels like open table formats are having their moment in the sun, so to speak. I don't think 2-3 years ago this was the case. We can get into that in a bit. I think I'd love to talk about the kind of the historical stuff you've been looking at, but it feels like for a lot of reasons, OpenTable, and I think the rise, it's sort of this weird thing where you're seeing the rise of OpenTable and also the rise of dedicated query engines, being sort of a first class citizen. Like that's where I kind of lump you at, where it's not like you're building out another Databricks or Snowflake or Dremio or something like that. It's a way different thing where you know what you're really good at. But if I were to go back like probably 4 or 5 years ago, I don't know that anyone would be building this type of a company. It's too focused, right? But now the opportunity's there. Am I off base on that observation or in your opinion? Or
no, actually, that's exactly correct. Because even when we started, right, like when I was just thinking, as I think back to some of my discussions with my co-founder like a few years ago, the honest question we had to ask ourselves was like, do we even want to try this? Like, this seems like a tall order, right? And the fact that we could break this space down into a smaller set of problems, I mean, building a computer engine is still insanely hard.
Yeah.
But it's not as hard or like close to even as hard as building a full stack database with ingestion, storage, metadata management, like all of the associated stuff. So it allows you to sort of build narrowly on one piece that you are betting is important. Right, important enough that it can sustain a group or a business. And then as you accumulate more resources through proving yourself on that one piece, you can then hopefully add the next thing, which is valuable, or the next logical addition, let's say. Mm-hmm. But yeah, zero hopes of embarking on what we did if it wasn't for a lot of building blocks that we could take for granted through stuff like the open table formats, like catalogs, you know, like ingestion getting better, object storage, like just constantly improving, stuff like that.
Was that an option for you though? I mean, was that a consideration at some point where you were going to build kind of the full end-to-end data stack?
So I'd like to think that we would always have been smart enough not to try, but I doubt that's the case. I think I think there were some early in the journey. I still remember, like super late at night, when we were experimenting with some. Hey, can we build something that's super fast and prove it on like one operator? I think it was a join or a very like specific type of join. And my co-founder Adi like came running to me saying, "Hey, listen, look at these amazing results at this operator level." And I was like, "Okay, what are the assumptions underlying this, right?" And he was like, "Yeah, you know, customer has all this data lying somewhere in like the S3, and we ingest it into this warehouse type storage layer of ours. And while doing so, we do all of this cool stuff, and then we query it." And I was just imagining myself pitching it to anybody. And I didn't think there would be takers, right, for like this new company that was asking you to move your data from S3. And obviously, a lot of big names convince you to do it, and you're happy to because you know you trust them and you know that their scale. But I think there was already a little bit of fatigue with that, like just move data more than you had to. I'm not saying it's never needed, more than you had to. And having the complexity with dealing with keeping them in sync, making them discoverable, governed, secure in multiple places. So I just felt with the wisdom of some hindsight that this would fall into that hard to build and hard to sell category. So not worth trying.
That's really interesting. So walk me through this. It's rare I get to talk to people who are, I think, building something from the ground up. On the scale that you are, like, walk me through this. What was the first line of code that you wrote? Do you remember?
It was that to prove that like a operator, in this case, like a basic scan and a join. So that was, I think, the first line of code that that got written. It was barely a 2 or 3 member team at the time. And it was more to prove to ourselves that, hey, listen, something is possible here. We still had no idea whether this would be an end-to-end query engine and, you know, that we didn't know how long it would take or exactly, because it's like, you know, when you're building, like, let's say a complex piece of machinery, right, and you build the smallest piece to prove to yourself even that there's something here, you worry that, hey, there's these 20 other pieces that when combined with this first piece would, and you know, you're building early, right? So you have implementation inefficiencies and things like that. So you worry that some of them will sort of cascade and eat away any sort of major benefit that you hope to achieve. So I think by then you're like just way in, like you're I think you're so enamored with the problem. You're having fun along the way. And I think that's kind of one area where I'm grateful for the venture ecosystem. Small folks who take sort of small bets that force you to be frugal and allow you to sort of experiment on such hard things without you taking like this existential risk, and still keeping it like a time-bound experiment, right? Like, hey, don't go and burn like tens of millions of dollars. So for example, for us, that was under like $1.5 million, I think, before we knew that, okay, listen, we can put this into the hands of someone that can use it.
Interesting. Seems like a smart way of going about it. And if you kind of fast forward from whenever you got started to today, being frugal it's a good habit to get into. I think you're possibly competing against other companies that are now having to learn that lesson the hard way. Walk me through that. Actually, an interesting thing before we were started recording, you said you've been reading blogs from 2 or 3 years ago. What are you, like a historian or something? Like, why do you like to feel nostalgic? Like, what's going on?
No, I mean, it's like we're all sort of frogs in this saucepan, right? Like with water. So we don't realize how hot the water is getting because it gets gradually hotter. So the best way to sort of zoom out a little bit is just look at some stuff that was written 4 years ago or 3 years ago and just zoom back to now. So not necessarily predictions, because, you know, those are usually just directional anyway, but just what people were expressing, the sentiment, what they were talking about as possibly being important or you know. So that's something I really enjoy. And it sort of helps me sort of in the present day figure out what for me is signal and what is noise. And it's sort of one of the only ways to stay sane, right? So that's one of my primary use cases.
Oh, that's super cool. What are there any articles that stand out or any blog posts that stand out for you?
Nothing that I can specifically name, but I think 2-3 years ago, you know, you would come across whether it's it was at conferences or articles, you know, it was anything to do with sound, like development practices, like let's say modeling or squeezing efficiency out of your systems, was considered like a stupid thing to do, right? Like it wasn't cool. It was also not cool to question, hey, am I over engineering this thing? Is there too much bloat? And I don't know, I think like it was just this prevailing mindset at the time. And it was almost like being an NFT skeptic at the peak of the NFT craze. So you were like, yeah, exactly. So you wonder whether, like, you know, you don't get anything anymore and that it's all downhill from here. And then at some point you're like, okay, there's some sensible or things that I can relate to that still exist. So that sort of thing. And I mean, it just helps you build confidence on some aspect of your own judgment or gut, I guess.
Well, I mean, when researching my new book that will be coming out this year, it's like I started reading articles and books even from the 50s, 60s, maybe earlier, actually 1950s and 60s. One article by his last name was Mealy, I think George Mealy, but he talked about 1967. And I think the tone of it was, with data, we're no closer to defining what it is, and you know, than we were for the past 1,000 years or something like that. So I was like, I'm still trying to figure out how to, basically get value out of it. And I'm like, oh crap. So it's basically the same thing he was talking about back then is the same thing we're talking about now. It's it's funny. Just because I mean you'd like to think that all the problems you're seeing are new, but I don't think I've basically gone from like in chronological order from like the very beginning all the way to today, and there's nothing very new under the sun, I would say. The euphoria that we have on technology, it's always there because you always have to have something new to get excited about. Everything has a shelf life in terms of how cool it is. That's the same as fashion and music. Tech is no different.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, nothing is inherently bad, right? Like I remember 20, 30 years ago, everything was sort of centralized, right? Like central IT, it was a bad word, right? And for good reason, probably. And then we had, hey, everything being pushed down where line of business would make their own technology choices. And it was true even in the data world, right? Like you're taught case studies of how Tableau sold heavily to business users, or Snowflake was more successful in selling to line of business folks as opposed to central IT folks, and how that was like the superpower and things like that. And I'm not saying Snowflake did that. I'm just saying that external folks sort of attribute that to them. And we used to think that, hey, that's the future, right? Everything is going to be decentralized. But data is increasingly getting at least some core functions, right, that have to be done upstream that are common across all end users, whether it's quality or, you know, those types of things, good modeling, the essential minimal modeling that needs to be done before you can do very, very narrow domain-specific stuff. That seems to still be happening with central platform teams. And it's quietly moved back to that, right? Like, so it feels like, yeah, there's this constant change from one to the other and back to the one, but with a new name. And we've lived through some extreme jargon in the last 2 or 3 years.
Oh, give me some examples.
I don't want to disparage any of them, really. Like, I just guess I haven't like understood them as well as I should. So you know, when I see someone saying that, hey, listen, it's almost like religiously when you talk about something, that's when you feel that like you probably are losing objectivity. So whether it is something around like, you know, advocating the benefits of, let's say, a fabric or a mesh or this or that. All of that has like valuable principles, right? Like, but you can't say that is the only way and that, you know, that the other way is wrong. And you have, there's so much nuance in adapting stuff like that to your context. And and you see over, let's say, the last 4 years, I'm sure the different conferences and talks that you've done, you know exactly what the latest buzzword is. And then the next year you don't hear it as much. And that sort of a thing. And this, I was just a few hours ago today, I was at a massive bank's technology conference. And there were like 3 out of 8 sessions that were Gen AI focused. And I was thinking, that, yeah, 3 years ago, this would have been blockchain. 4 years ago, this would have been something else, you know, the dominant themes. And hopefully some of them like actually stick, right? Like, prove their value and just become another thing that is part of that bank's tech stack or the tools that they use, as opposed to being like the separate thing that you have to talk about so heavily.
I would like to get your take on this though, right? Because it feels like generative AI it definitely is the big thing right now. I don't think anyone will dispute that. I don't think anyone will dispute this. But at the same time, like, what do you think it does to infrastructure? And, well, we'll start with infrastructure. I'm sure we could pick another million other ways it could change things. But you're an infrastructure person. And, what are your thoughts on this? Like, what does Gen AI do to it?
So in complete, like, honesty, this is a topic that's it's almost like worried me for a while, right? Like, not because I think it won't have an impact or it will, but it's just hard to, at the infrastructure level, to figure out what it will do, right? And it's even more of a existential question in my business, because you're always trying to, like I said, filter out noise and retain signal. And this is one of the only areas where, you know, it's hard to tell, right? Like, A, it's hard to tell the impact. Second, it's hard to tell how immediate that impact will be. And as a founder, you're always trying to find the opportunity in things, right? So you're not just worried about the risk, you're also searching for the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think the few areas that I, as I was trying to put together the answers for my own business, like I tried a bunch of things which were quite like hopeless and left me disoriented. But at one point, I think as I just started thinking of different use cases, right? Like, and I said that let me stop thinking of some grand strategy. Let me just think of people, right? Like people or personas and things that they were trying to do or accomplish and where we can help, right? Like with what's available to us. So stuff that came to mind was, you know, like, hey, data engineers get bugged with problematic queries once a day or several times a week, right? Like how quickly can you take them from that point where they just get shot like this random ticket with a problematic query and they need to ideally diagnose or fix it, right? Like make that query be performant or cheaper or whatever else. And there you actually find some meaningful answers, right? Like you say that, hey, listen, what could the causes be? What data do you need to validate what the top cause and the second cause and the third cause is, and how can you like authoritatively say, hey, do this and this will fix it, or you know, in the future you can fix it for them, right? Two tinier things, like, you know, there's analysts that use your platform, and especially in the lake world, right? Like there's still the physical construct of data and how it's laid out, files, partitions, and the SQL world, which is just filters and stuff like that. And how can you make folks not have to get into the weeds of the physical data layout? Like, how can you purely keep them at the logical level? How can you do stuff like whether it's developing a query from scratch or you are a new analyst and team, you inherit a bunch of like gnarly long queries, all the way to, hey, I'm running an internal solution engineering and a customer success team. I'm helping customers solve some of these problems, or I'm trying to make my engine better. Where can I use a good old data collection that informs, like, or rather that enhances context and relevance? And some of the generative capabilities of models like this, right? Like, so for me, like one example is, how can I take like a super junior analyst and make them almost as good as one of my most senior engineers in diagnosing performance root causes, right? So things like that. But yeah, clearly work in progress. I don't have the answers yet. From a product perspective, I know that as a distributed compute engine, some of the things that we want to move towards are going beyond SQL, because it's just an example of a workload that we can execute in a highly parallelized distributed fashion, to more AI workloads. So that's probably something that we'll tap into later in the year.
What does that look like to you? What would be an AI workload?
So if you were to think of some of our core building blocks is this ability to break up a job into a tree of tasks, parallelize them, and then distribute them and have that happen hyper efficiently. And that job, this layer is agnostic to where the job came from, right? Like this could be a SQL query, which is, you know, which goes through this flow. But this could just as well be some sort of a Python program, which is asking for a prediction or a gradient search, or even a more complex sort of model training or inference serving, right? Anything that involves highly parallel processing. And that it helps that we've built this from scratch, because each of these blocks sort of evolved incrementally, and things like the parser sort of came last, right? Like the parser, planner, optimizer came last, mostly because they were best researched, and already it was like the lower levels that we really had to innovate on the most to the point of building from scratch. But yeah, that's one of the things that I'm most excited on, and I like wish I could allocate more time to.
With,
you know, given the constraints of the team and everything else.
That's interesting. I guess this brings up a question I like to ask founders of companies, tooling companies especially. But how do you determine how to allocate your time, focusing on the present, focusing on serving customers, while also keeping an eye on, you know, the future, right? So in this case, the future is generative AI. The next future, well, the future 4 years ago would have been blockchain. Like, how do you focus on the things that are going to help grow the revenue base and help make your customers happy versus maybe taking a bet on something that's not here yet.
So I think that's one of the hardest things, honestly, right? Like, and especially at a super young company, there's not too many people involved in that decisions, right? So it's quite a scary call. But I think over time you get a sense for where your bread and butter is. Hey, this is what will make us survive and grow. And fortunately, the SQL is like a gargantuan market, right? Like, and it's this, especially when you're in a market like India, you look at some massive companies who are still like very, very behind on the data curve. Right? So it tells you that like it's only the top 1% of companies that are even mature on data. So even what we've built now it's so early in the game that, you know, there is value in doubling down, building depth there. I do get asked by my team, you know, hey, is this the right thing to pick or is it just another hot thing, right? Like, and my answer is that, hey, listen, look at SQL, right? Like every engine runs SQL, right? But you have to pick a piece or a portion of the market or an application space where it's particularly hard or painful or expensive with existing tech and build for that group or that use case first, right? Otherwise, what is it unique that you bring? What is really unique about you? Why do you deserve to exist or thrive or survive, right? So take the same approach to this new thing, right? So if we do it, let's talk to some really, really sophisticated customers, meaning they would have experimented very well, right? Like they are not going to be a company that's starved for resources and not do their research in terms of the best tech out there. So if you've talked to all of them and they are able to articulate very, very clearly why an area is valuable, but is hard or painful or like grossly suboptimal with existing tech, then like stick your neck out and make the bet there. So, but the fortunate part is most of what we build, we're so young that it ends up being fundamentally valuable as a building block anyway. So if the bet can involve building something that is fungible, and not very narrowly built for just one domain. That's always like, yeah, just have some optionality, right?
That makes a lot of sense. And I guess another question I like to ask right now, especially with the rise of Gen AI, as you mentioned, you're at this bank conference, and there were three talks on Gen AI, or there was, what was it?
A bunch of them, yeah. A
bunch of talks.
Yeah. So, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it's like, so how are you talking to customers about generative AI? Because I'm sure every customer's like, hey, Vishnu, like, could you guys do Gen AI for us, like, today or something? I don't know what kind of questions they ask, but maybe some flavor of this.
So. No, it's absolutely the case, right? And I think the good part, I guess, is that they're sort of flooded with proposals and companies pitching to them. The hard part is I think that they're a little anxious that they're towards the end of their experiment leash. So I think, I think budgets will start shrinking on that front. I mean, and by all accounts, budgets have been vacuumed out a little bit from other areas and have been funneled into this bucket that they call ERR, experimental recurring revenue, right? So
yeah.
So... So I think there are a few use cases that like are the low-hanging fruit, I guess, that everyone will do. It's just leaving money on the table if you don't. But the more striking ones, the more deeper ones, the more domain-specific ones, I think are something that will start to come out. And that's where we'll know which companies have really like done justice to experimenting, evaluating, and things like that.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's always hard for me to tell too, because I mean, I travel the world. I don't even know how often, a lot. And it feels like AI is just one of these, we'll just say AI generically, but it's one of these things that everyone talks about and every company says they're doing it. When I poke under the hood, I'm like, it's like you have a POC going on. It's usually not, nothing, you know, but it is interesting though. And it feels like, you know, again, if we were to go back a couple of years ago, say to the data tooling space, a lot of those companies are now pivoting to being, you know, AI companies and so forth. So I imagine it's hard too, even if you still have budget left, to figure out, okay, so who's, you know, as you mentioned, companies are getting pitched all the time on AI solutions and so forth. And my big question is, how would I know who's legit and who's not? So it's hard.
You know, it absolutely is, right? Like everyone's tagline is was earlier, hey, we do this, and now their tagline is, hey, we do this powered by AI, right? Like your domain names have changed to .ai and everything else. And I think, like, yeah, it makes sense. I guess it's from their point of view, why would you not cash in on this thing that's top of mind in your for your customer? But I think there will be that fatigue as well that comes in, right? Like, so if you aren't able to prove that your product is discernibly better as a result of the AI, and like, so what is it doing? Is it bumping up the value for a customer? Is it like improving, like dramatically improving your existing features? Is it allowing you to deliver on new features that were previously not possible? Is it showing up in your retention rates and, you know, your usage, how much your customers use the product? So I think those metrics are still, like, the jury's out on all of those, right? So, and I'm sure there's some companies that are doing great on that front. It's just that it can't be everybody.
And it kind of brings me back to, I think, where we initially started. It's underlying all this is still a lot of infrastructure, right? And I don't see a scenario where query engines go away anytime soon. But I'm curious, where do you think the future is going with like analytical engines and so forth?
So I have like an opinionated belief here, and good. I don't know how much of it is shaped by bias, but I think like as more like strong software engineers and data engineers come together to own the data platform, I see them wanting to do a lot more in object storage, not because I love it or my company's built on it, but because you will need object storage for AI, right? Like, so it's the most natural landing place for your semi-structured and unstructured data. So you will have, like, if you're on AWS, you will have that central repository of all of your data, transactional and non-transactional, in S3. Yeah. Right. And once you have it there, you are going to have to enforce some level of security, governance, blah, 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 around discoverability around that data. And you will be tempted to say, hey, listen, can I do as much as I can directly from there without moving it anywhere? Mm-hmm. Right. So, I would talk to the same like customer, let's say 2 years ago, and all of their data would land in a data warehouse directly. Now the pattern has, the standard pattern has almost become like, if I go to somebody of a certain size or above, their default pattern is data lands in object storage, goes through as much transformation in object storage as possible, and the final consumption ready data is sort of loaded into a warehouse, which they hope gives them the performance, the concurrency, and hopefully cost efficiency as well. So stuff has been shifting left, and the left is object storage, right? So I saw a tweet the other day, I forget who, saying that, you know, almost every database has started to use object storage as its persistent sort of storage layer, right? Like, so as a persistent backend. And stuff you mentioned earlier, like open table formats and others, like allow like object storage to just become just way more useful and powerful and useful from a query engine's point of view, with the amount of rich metadata that they give you to help you with query planning, data skipping, and all of the stuff that database engines do, right? So for me, my product vision for the technology, the view of the world that I see is that people will take the simplest and most elegant route possible. And if data is already in a central location, if we can evolve our tech to allow them to just do more with the data being in that one place, meaning you have some jobs to be done, right? Like you need data at a certain ingestion latency, you have a certain volume of data that you want to process in a certain processing time, like for an ETL job, you have a certain query latency that you need to deliver at a certain query traffic. And those are like some of your jobs to be done. And obviously the operations that you want to run in your query. So if there's an engine that can do it from there, then awesome. So I see that view of the world, object storage dominating. And therefore, as an infrastructure layer, can I play my role in making object storage more powerful or useful?
How do you come up with a query engine that I guess that satisfies a lot of the, variation that you're going to find in object storage, right? So, I mean, traditionally, when you write a query engine, it's usually adapted to a specific database. You know, the query planner works on a database and the optimizer and so forth. But how does this work when you have, a bunch of different table formats, different file types, and Lord knows what else you have to deal with?
Yeah, absolutely, right? So I think the good thing with table formats is that they are a level of abstraction higher than, let's say, the actual in the weeds work of the query engine. So they help you plan better, skip data better, you know, use indexes where available, and those are increasingly available now on Lakehouse table formats. But where you see the variations is, like you said, in file format. Fortunately, it's very, very, very overwhelmingly Parquet right now. Mm-hmm. So narrows the scope some. But even within Parquet, right, like there's different flags you could enable with stats, without stats, with indexing, without, what file sizes do you use? Is it like a batch pipeline with like, you know, neatly chunky file sizes of like 128 MB, or is it like streaming pipelines with files that are KBs in size? So yeah. I think that is really the complexity of our job, right? To still deliver on the use case. So it influences literally how we build. Right? Like, what's our architecture? Like, you know, how do you compensate for some of these things? And it also helps that, you know, having built this from scratch, we know exactly, like, so in our first, let's say, 10 customers, what we would do is, hey, okay, your data layout is such and such. So we will read in so many chunk sizes, or we'll set this flag to this, and so on and so forth, right? Like, and you get performance. And what you realize is that, hey, all of these are tunables, right? Like, and it's today taking an expert to tune those, but it's based on certain observations of the data layout, et cetera. But the cool part is that, let's say if you can build for a common denominator sort of expectations in terms of file format, table format, file sizes, so on and so forth, you can learn some of these parameters. And then, like, you know, you can have this be an engine that sort of adapts over time. It starts off faster and cheaper off the bat, but then gets even more performant with the queries that it sees, with the underlying data layout that it sees, the access patterns that it sees, right? What to cache, what not to cache at the data cache level, and so on, right? Like, how aggressive, like, you have 8,000 tables in a data lake sometimes, but do you query 8,000 tables? Hell no, right? Like, it's usually a few that, so cache the tables of the metadata of those tables more aggressively or preferentially. So, and all of this is based on data that you have access to, right? You're after all processing queries, you're connected to the catalog. So we feel that, you know, there is potential there to actually make that a strength, where if you look at like a data warehouse or other lakehouse engines, if you have a medium sized cluster, for example, that customer A and B have, and medium size sort of corresponds, let's say, to X vCPUs and Y amount of RAM, all parameters in those two clusters are identical, whereas the workloads could be like completely opposite, right?
Right.
Whereas we have the ability to say, listen, this is like, these are similar in terms of the processing and memory horsepower that they have, but inside they're like drastically different in terms of how the flags have been auto set based on what we've learned. And in truth, we've started taking baby steps in this direction. So we've right now started seeing the power of this. But this is, again, one of the things that I'm most excited about in the next like year and a half.
That's super cool. So we're kind of wrapping up. Like, you spend your time between India and the Bay Area, right?
Yeah.
Walk me through some of the your observations right now in terms of the Indian tech scene. When I was there, I felt like there's a lot of stuff happening right now there. There's a lot.
Even today's event, for example, right? Like, so I think what we've seen is that, especially in the larger end of the tech spectrum and the enterprise side of things, it's very clearly like a distributed setup, right? Like, you have essentially, obviously, HQ is in the US. Mm-hmm. These organizations all are headquartered elsewhere in the world. But it's very, very, very common, right? Like, so for data teams to be based out of India. Mm-hmm. So if we just think back at the event that you and I met at, so there was a bunch of folks that spoke from Walmart, from Lululemon.
Oh, yeah.
Like, right, like you could not imagine that you were in Bangalore, for example, right?
Mm-mm.
So so the event that I was at today, top three bank globally, and like all their entire data team was in Bangalore. So they're based in India, right? So and I think that is a thing, right? Like, so these are internally positioned as global capability centers, and I think it also helps because a lot of the early data engineering talent, I think, came from the IT services companies for which India is obviously famous. And it coincided with like GCCs or these global capability centers becoming a thing. So you find these massive tech parks or rather these like special economic zones or these huge office complexes that house like the tech teams of like companies like Rakuten, let's say, right? Like with like 20 different groups, one of which is now the other group, right? So it's pretty cool that, you know, the like my work now has it requires me almost to both be in the US, not just in the Bay Area, but also very heavy in India, both because a lot of my early engineering team is here as well as a lot of customers are here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting because I think as an American, it felt like, you know, I assume maybe that's the impression Americans still have, but it feels like India is very much like the back office of the world, right? But it seems like, I mean, I would almost wager to guess the engineering talent is on par in some cases doing maybe more forward-looking stuff than even the US in some cases from people I talked to. I thought it was definitely cool to see.
Yeah, I think it's like it benefits a lot because the senior benefits a lot because these are, after all, the Indian arm of a large US company, right? So hopefully they've learned a lot of best practices. They're like the leadership often are folks who've moved back from the US either because they were, you know, of Indian ethnicity to begin with, and it was like something that they could be convinced to do, and so on, right? Like, it meant like them getting a couple of hops up the ladder in exchange for moving back. So it works out. So it's not that these have popped up in isolation. They really have popped up because of a very careful decision by mothership to say, hey, let me have a satellite center. And I think they go through their own maturity cycles as well, right? Like, so if you find a center that's super new, or at least a center that was set up 10 years ago, they would be doing the back office stuff is what I guess. But as they prove that, hey, listen, we can deliver value and, we should have a seat at the table, they're increasingly given more important work. And I think of data as like probably the most exciting thing because, wow, if it's gotten to data, then it's reached a tipping point, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. What's the startup scene there? I didn't really figure that out.
So I think like if you look at the startup scene from an American's perspective, you'll notice that, hey, the consumer startups are obviously hot. So, hey, what's the Indian Amazon? What's the Indian Uber? And so on. And then there's also like the more nuanced, narrower apps for like delivery and stuff like that. But outside of that, fintech is huge. It's huge, right? Like just because of the size of, in terms of the number of people in the market. So fintech tends to be pretty massive. Payment gateways, lending apps, and everything like from there, investing and stuff like that. On the data and tooling side, I'm excited at least like early signs of some companies coming out from the space, but obviously this is still like the newest frontier. So whenever I meet another infrastructure or tooling or data founder, I'm always like, let's hang out.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, and I hope it continues. Like I said, I was impressed by the people that I'd met there. It felt like it was just a very strong concentration of talent. Like I go to the Bay Area and I see it there, obviously, but that Bangalore may have been the only other place where I was like, this is definitely, and I think there's just definitely more engineers there in general. I guess the only thing I noticed as well in Bangalore is it felt like, because it's such a huge city, I think it's really hard for people to network and get to meet up. Maybe I'm wrong in that, but it felt like it was just, it's hard, I think, for people who haven't been there to understand just how massive this place is and how hard it is to get around sometimes because of traffic. But
I think like north of 10 million people and it's grown super fast. So, I think the good part is that it's such a concentrated pool of people that the data subculture and the other subcultures will all sort of thrive. Mm-hmm. So in fact, the group that that hosted the event actually started off as an informal meetup. So friend and a bunch of the group there that were involved and one of the early sort of proponents of saying, hey, it's valuable to just meet up and hang out, right? Like, so I remember we hosted one at our office. So that's how I knew a lot of the folks who were at the event as well.
That's super cool. Yeah, and I'm on like a WhatsApp group with everybody now, and it's super cool to see there's a lot of enthusiasm in there right now and a lot of great ideas. So, well, cool, man. It's been great chatting with you, Vishnu. I hope you have the chat again and hope to see you around as well.
When you're around next or when I'm visiting.
Yeah, for sure. For people who want to learn more about you or what you're up to, how can they do that?
Yeah, sure. Just drop me an email at vishnu@e6data.com or the website, LinkedIn, anything's good. Always keen to chat, learn more. Thanks again.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Take care. Yeah.